Hello, everyone. Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm Violet Tang, sitting in for Nina Xiang. Our guest today is Sachin Dosh, the founder and CEO of Wave Co-Living. Wave Co-Living is a Hong Kong-based co-living company, which provides modern, conveniently located and affordable living spaces for millennials and young professionals.The founder Sachin previously worked as the head of private real estate at APG Asset Management in Hong Kong. Wave on Boundary, Wave's first property with 160 bedrooms, has opened in Prince Edward in Hong Kong in August this year. Such a facility is now 95% occupied. Wave has asset-owning model to carry out the rental business. It's now close to acquire another asset in Hong Kong.Through shared space like living room, movie room, kitchen, gym, games area, laundry, and the use of technology, Wave aims to build close-knit communities in its co-living spaces. In November this year, Warburg Pincus has invested $181 million to Wave Co-Living. Wave plans to grow its portfolio to over 10,000 bedrooms across major Asian cities over the next 5 years.Over time, Wave intends to launch new rental accommodation options catering to different target demographics. Here's the interview. Hope you enjoy it.
Hello, Sachin. Welcome back to China Money Podcast. Great to talk to you again 3 years after we last spoke while you were working at the Dutch pension fund APG. And we knew that not long after you started your own company, Wave Co-Living, and recently you closed a very big financing round led by Warburg Pincus. I'm sure a lot of interesting stories you can share with us, but maybe start with your thinking and vision when you started Wave Co-Living, and why did you decide to choose this sector over perhaps many other choices?
So Nina, it's good to be back, on China Money Network. So as you said, in my previous career, I was, in an investment role. And, as part of that, I was investing across the Asia Pacific region, whether that's sort of in Sydney, Singapore, Hong Kong, Shanghai. And a lot of people were talking about attracting, innovative young talent into the cities. But not many people were talking about how are these young people going to be able to live in these cities,because they happen to be the most expensive cities when it comes to residential real estate and accommodation. The other piece of this is, even though a lot of young people are very in tune with sort of technology, there is an increasing sense of alienation, there's an increased sort of desire for a sense of community. So Wave Co-Living really is sort of marrying together value for money accommodation that is designed and targeted towards millennials and young professionals,and bringing that alongside a sort of sense of broader community that we provide, not only through design at our properties, but through the community team and the events that we have within Wave.
Is this the only idea you had when you debated about where to enter as a space or industry for your own startup? What were some other choices you had?
Look, I'm always full of ideas. So, there was quite a few different things that were floating around in my mind. But really, rental accommodation was one that, made clear sense given just how difficult and unaffordable accommodation has become for young people. And, Hong Kong is a great example for that. If you look at, a city like Hong Kong, a young person coming out of university, there are some studies that have been done that'll take them 27 years.Before they can afford to buy a place to live, and that is if prices don't move from where they are today. So really, rental accommodation was one that made a lot of sense, not only from an investment standpoint, but also from a need standpoint, but also how many interesting things one can do with rental accommodation. If you look at sort of co-working and office space, co-working has completely disrupted, the office sector. But if you look at rental accommodation and accommodation more broadly,it still continues to be what it used to be 15, 20, 30 years ago. And it's a space that was just waiting for disruption. And that's why I was very quickly, very focused on the co-living space.
And co-working was never one of the choices you considered?
Not really for for myself, and there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, with co-working, obviously it's a space that has now been fairly broadly considered, accessed, and developed. There's quite a few dominant players now, whether it's in sort of from a global perspective or even purely from an Asian context. And the barriers to entry, frankly, for co-working are a lot lower than they are for something like co-living. So again, the focus for me was how to create a platform that, inherently had value in the concept, but also it was a concept that was not that easy to replicate, which I believe co-living is compared to something like co-working.
There are a lot of similarities between co-working and co-living. Some people say that part of the idea behind co-working is that it makes working for people who work in small companies or work on their own less lonely, so they can join a community. Co-living is similar, like you just described. But we have seen also that co-working is perhaps much more developed compared to co-living. How much a gap there is between co-working and co-living? And how many years do you think co-living will take to perhaps develop into a state or the stage where co-working is currently right now?
That's a difficult one to predict. But if you look at co-working as, as a concept, as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of very large players now, in the co-working space. And on the one hand, while, co-working as a concept was born out of the need for, that sense of community, especially for smaller businesses, where perhaps taking your own lease and, fitting out an office space wasn't commercially or economically viable, the way co-working has evolved, now a lot of large enterprises are moving into co-working. So the whole fundamental premise behind co-working now is, in my view, a little bit lost in how the sector has evolved. Which is not to say it's not a good thing, because a lot of established companies still want to attract good talent, and creating that fun environment to work in is very important for them to be able to retain these people. But co-working has evolved substantially from where it started off a few years ago. In terms of co-living, it is still in its early stages. Based on what we hear, Weave Co-living now is probably the best capitalized co-living company in the world. And we're a 1.5-year-old company. So clearly, there is huge runway when it comes to co-living, as a sector in terms of its evolution and where it can get to. But if you look at the grassroots need for a concept like this, good quality rental accommodation in convenient locations that is well designed with that broader sense of community, the need is very obvious. And the growth potential for the sector is enormous. My view is over time, there will be some sort of convergence also between co-working and co-living, because the target demographic to a great extent in co-working is very similar to the target demographic in co-living. But one fundamental difference again is it's someone's office versus someone's home. And what one needs to provide for someone's home in form of security, comfort, is very different. So on the one hand, while there is, a degree of convergence in these two spaces, I think there also needs to be a distinction so that you can maintain that distinction between your place of work and your place of residence.
The convergence idea is very interesting. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But I want to ask you, what's your assessment of the Asian co-living market right now? We just talked with the founder of Ucommune, which is China's largest co-working company, if you count how many desks they have, how much office space they have. So his idea is for co-working, he feels like if we compare the industry's development as a marathon, the industry has probably run 6-7 kilometers, so still very early stage. So what's your assessment of co-living? Perhaps, we know it's going to be much earlier stage, but exactly how early?
That's a very interesting question. Again, as I mentioned before, you know, if you look at the global co-living landscape, you know, an 18-month-old company is already the best capitalized company. And, you know, in the UK and the US, there are other co-living operators that have been in business now for, you know, significantly longer than us. And, you know, they have more facilities, they have probably bigger communities already. But the interesting thing, if you look at it from an Asian context, is, you know, people are used to apartment living. It's not a new concept for someone in Singapore or Hong Kong or Tokyo. In a way, the shift from traditional apartment living to co-living, I believe in Asia, will be a lot smoother. Also, you know, look at Hong Kong. I mean, space is at such a premium. So to the extent you can create, you know, stunning communal space with, you know, good outdoor space, you know, space for people to get together, the inherent premium in a space like that is quite enormous. So my view is co-living probably has an equal, if not longer, runway as co-working. But in terms of, you know, if co-living is a marathon, we're probably still running the first 200 meters, if not even shorter. So it's just, you know, two industries in very different stages of evolution. But if you again take a step back, the main premise of this continues to be the need to share. The big social shift in, you know, millennials and young people, where ownership in of itself is not the goal. They want to spend, you know, their capital on experiences. They want to enjoy life. They want to have flexibility. For a lot of people, buying an apartment will often be the biggest purchase they make in their life. But that also means a significant amount of their capital is locked into a single asset. A lot of young people are saying, you know, I want to live in a fun place. I want to live in a well-designed place. But I don't want to be in the cycle of, you know, paying my mortgage for the next 30 years. So there are real estate shifts. There are social shifts, all of which are driving co-living and co-working simultaneously.
And for your company, the vision is to be an Asian operator or a global operator?
Well, the long-term aspiration is always to be global, but initially, you know, with Warburg's investment and, you know, the business plan that we have, we will be an Asia-Pacific focused operator for the foreseeable future, starting with Hong Kong. There are certain other markets where we've begun our research on and exploring the feasibility of the business model, and early signs are very encouraging and positive. So to start off with Asia-Pacific, and, you know, over time, who knows where all of this takes us.
If we talk about Asia, China is perhaps one of the biggest markets for co-living. We already have seen a number of startups in China raising also a lot of money to finance their expansion. I think in China, the term people use for co-living is called long-term apartment rentals. And we have seen some problems emerging from that sector. They often engage in rapid expansions where they rent out apartments to students or young professionals right after they finish the decoration. And there has been reports of deaths, people perhaps suffering from the high level of pollution. Mm-hmm. How do you observe what's happening in the Chinese co-living market? And if China is a target market, what's your strategy of expanding there?
Look, firstly, I think it's very unfortunate, you know, some of the incidents that I've read about as well. But what I would say is one aspect of what we do that we never compromise on is the safety and security of our residents. The way we design our buildings, the process that we go through is very rigorous. At the end of the day, this is a place for someone to live. And it is, you know, my responsibility and the team's responsibility to make sure that it's as safe a living environment as possible that we give to our residents. One fundamental difference between, you know, a lot of the Chinese operators in the co-living space versus what Weave is doing is we actually own the assets that we use as co-living facilities. What that means is when we acquire an asset, we go through extensive refurbishment oftentimes. You know, these refurbishments have to go through quite strict sort of approvals and regulatory process in Hong Kong. So before we can open something, these have been vetted by multiple agencies in Hong Kong before our residents can actually move in. So that is one sort of check and balance in place. You know, while scale is important to us, you know, it's never going to be at the cost of, you know, safety and security of our residents. Again, you know, we want to grow, but we want to grow responsibly, which is something we will continue to focus on as a company. one comment you made was, you know, in China, sort of co-living is sort of long-term rental apartments. I think it's actually slightly different. With co-living, at least the way Weave looks at co-living, we're really deconstructing the elements of the entire home within a building. So that your bedroom is your private space, but you have many different spaces. There's a hierarchy of spaces that one can use based on how frequently you use it. So as opposed to, you know, simply trying to speed to market in terms of bringing a home onto the market, we spend a lot of time on design. We spend a lot of time in conceptualization, in product development to make sure that we are creating the right product for the right sort of location. And I would say even in China, the development of the sector has clearly been, you know, very rapid, you know, having been one of the main focus areas of the central government as well, you know, increasing the supply of rental accommodation. In Hong Kong, it is more market-driven. It is less policy-driven. There is a clear need for the product. So the evolution of the space in this market is also occurring slightly differently. There hasn't been a rush to gain market share because it's a policy thrust. It's a little bit more organic in this market.
So if, as you say, you actually own the property, so that means your business model is really capital-intensive and asset-heavy, that's going to impact how much you can expand. And how do you balance, you know, the pace of expansion that's required if you want to take a market leading position versus the ownership element?
When I look at market leadership, it's not simply about the number of properties that one manages. I think it is about the quality of what you own and what you operate and how you operate the assets. You know, even though we have one operating asset right now, you know, I'm fairly confident that in terms of quality, in terms of the service, in terms of the community, I would consider ourselves to be a market leader already. I nuance scale versus market leadership slightly more perhaps than, you know, it is done in other markets. You're absolutely right that with an asset-heavy business, the pace of bringing sort of properties to the market is going to be slower. But it's also going to allow us to have very close control over the quality of our product. You know, as opposed to simply signing up a property to add another, you know, 100 beds, we will think very long and hard about whether a new property is additive to the company and its portfolio, whether it's a location that residents want to be in. So perhaps we may grow a little bit slower than an asset-light business, but I think our quality of our growth will probably be a lot better than an asset-light business as well. Having said that, clearly once we establish the Weave brand, once we can demonstrate the quality of our product, we may selectively go into an asset-light business as well, but the main thrust of our business is always going to remain ownership of assets.
Now you've opened one location in Hong Kong. What's your expansion blueprint look like?
So again, you know, as I mentioned, the expansion plan is to go across Asia Pacific. But if you talk sort of the next 18 months, the focus will probably be very firmly on Hong Kong. We have just secured another asset in Hong Kong as well. That's going to be in Hung Hom, which is undergoing very rapid infrastructure development with the Sha Tin to Central Link and some of the other initiatives going on around there. We're very close to acquiring a couple of more properties, including one on the Hong Kong Island, and another one close to the high-speed rail station. So our immediate plan is to focus on Hong Kong, to be in more sort of infill, infrastructure-driven locations that are convenient for people, whether they work in Central, Admiralty, or out towards Kowloon East, which is the sort of new CBD that's developing in Hong Kong as well.
So in the next 18 months, how many locations do you expect to have?
It's hard to predict, but, you know, given the business plan that we have right now, my view is in the next 18 months, we should be at close to 2,000 beds in Hong Kong.
And that will be
6 to 8 properties.
And what about after Hong Kong or outside of Hong Kong? Where have you focused on your next phase of expansion?
We've started, you know, some research on other gateway cities across Asia, you know, being Singapore, Seoul, Sydney, Melbourne. But again, for us, it's not growing for the sake of growing. We have to make sure that the environment is conducive for the product, that we can build the right sort of team to execute in these markets as well. And these are markets in which we can create scale. So a handful of gateway cities will probably be our focus after Hong Kong.
And you didn't mention China, mainland China. So I guess that's not the place where you would like to go.
We would look at the Chinese market as well. But one has to be, you know, also mindful about not biting more than one can chew. Even if you say going into China, does that mean going into Shenzhen or going into Shanghai or going into Guangzhou or Beijing? I mean, you know, each market has very different dynamics. We do have an aspiration to go into mainland China as well. But again, it has to be on the back of the right team. It has to be with the ability to create scale, because it's very hard to be in multiple cities at the same time in China, because, you know, distances are far. You know, each city has its own dynamics. It has own set of sort of dominant players. So we will be mindful as to how and when we grow into that market. You know, perhaps it's through an acquisition of a platform or, you know, joint venturing with another platform, but it's not the immediate focus for us right now. But over time, I mean, you know, in Asia Pacific, you know, China is a big part of Asia Pacific.
Now, if we extend the horizon a little bit longer, let's talk about mid long term, perhaps in 5 years' time, where do you see the company's growth at that stage?
Yeah, in 5 years' time, I think we would like to be in sort of 8 to 10 gateway cities in Asia Pacific, you know, that being sort of Hong Kong, Singapore, Seoul, Tokyo, Sydney, Melbourne, Shanghai, Shenzhen, maybe Mumbai, Bangalore, these types of cities.
And how many locations? Just roughly. I know it's very long term.
It's hard to say, but I mean, you know, our business plan is sort of over the next, you know, next 5 to 7 years, we would like to have 10,000 beds across Asia Pacific. So, you know, if a typical project is 200 bedrooms, that's 50 properties.
Wow, that's very ambitious, but also not so rapid as perhaps some Chinese companies will try to target. Now, let's go back to the convergence point you mentioned previously. You said co-working and co-living might converge somehow in the future. How do you see that convergence take place? What kind of format? Well, what is the ultimate platform? You know, what does the ultimate co-working / co-living platform look like? Do they look like the Marriott Hotel Management Company? You know, they do the management of the property.
It could take many different forms. So, you know, if you look at the co-working space right now, the sort of dominant global player is WeWork. WeWork has dabbled in co-living with the WeLive product. The thesis behind that is, again, as I mentioned, that the customer who's going into co-working is also possibly a customer who would like to be in, you know, in co-living. Whether it takes the shape of an entire building, which is part co-working, part co-living, that could be a physical manifestation of those two coming together. Whether it's, you know, targeting the same customer across different properties, one being co-working in a more sort of business location, the other being co-living in a more residential location, but still sitting under the same brand umbrella, a little bit like, you know, WeWork does with WeLive. Or it could simply be, you know, a case of collaboration between a co-living operator and a co-working operator, where there's cross-sell between the two sets of customers and clients to give them a accommodation as well as sort of a workplace solution. So there's many different forms this can take. I don't think anyone's really worked out what that form is going to be, which also creates a bit of a white space for us to maybe we'll be the first one to tackle that.
So that implies perhaps you might also start a co-working operation.
Never say never. But it's not the plan right now, jokes aside. I mean, the focus really is co-living. But what I really mean by that comment is, as the founder of UCommune mentioned, co-working is sort of 20% into a marathon. So there's still a lot to go. So it's hard to predict how these two spaces will evolve and at what point maybe co-living catches up or co-working and co-living start converging. But the possibilities are sort of endless in how they can work together. So I wouldn't discount the possibility of us doing co-working, but there are no imminent plans.
Your company have been in operation for 1.5 years. What did you find was the biggest challenge?
Okay, there's plenty. I think for a startup, it's very important to hire people with the right attitude, you know, entrepreneurial people who sort of want to back a new concept, believe in a new way of doing something. And, you know, we've been very fortunate with the team, but to continue to grow and curate the team, you know, that is something that has been challenging, but also, you know, very, very rewarding and very exciting. Of course, with any other startup, the goal is to demonstrate a proof of concept, to show that it works, to show that it can be profitable, to bring in a good partner on board, good investor on board. It's taken us 18 months, but I think we've secured arguably the best partner that one could hope for, given Warburg Pincus's track record in growing and scaling up regional companies in the real estate space. So, you know, in an asset-heavy business, capital is always something that keeps you up at night. And, you know, finally, it is an operating business. You have residents who live there. Their safety, their comfort, it's very important, and that means that we have to take care of every little thing. There's a lot of detail that you're focusing on that, you know, maybe a lot of other people wouldn't even notice or wouldn't even see, but you notice it because you know that directly affects the comfort of your resident. Again, you know, too many, but for example, you know, we have half of our residents come from outside of Hong Kong, so they're non-Chinese. You know, for a lot of them, they're coming to Hong Kong for the first time. Adapting them to a new city, how we can help them sort of assimilate, you know, more into the city, just sort of helping them out. You know, some of them are homesick when they first, you know, move in, and you have to be, you know, quite careful in the way you interact with them, you know, how you make them feel at home, create that sense of belonging in a new environment. And it's an art. It's not a science. It's got nothing to do with investments. It's got nothing to do with finance. It really is a very personal thing. So in our community team spends a lot of time, you know, getting to know our residents and, you know, making sure they're happy sort of living there. So, you know, these are some of the softer things around community building and sort of co-living that perhaps other sectors don't face so much.
If some resident in your co-living space feel homesick, what would you do? It sounds a lot like babysitting almost.
It's not babysitting, but it could be, you know, something as, you know, as simple as, you know, having a movie night with, you know, where you show a movie which is, you know, from their home country, or having a sort of a food night where you order food from, you know, one of the restaurants from their home country. It could be something quite simple, but these things go a long way. You know, as someone myself who's moved cities, you know, four times now, you know, in my life, I realize the importance of that sort of comfort and familiarity that comes with eating something that you feel, you know, brings you back certain memories of childhood, or watching a movie where you can identify places or identify people. So a lot of these things sort of go into how we curate the community, how we keep our residents happy at Weave.
Now, since you have very ambitious plans for the future, but when you think about the future, what concerns you the most? Like, what kind of uncertainty that keeps you worried?
I wouldn't say what keeps me worried, but there's a quote I read which I sort of always remind myself of, in that if you can connect all the dots already, you're not thinking big enough. When I look out into the future, I don't know how all the dots are going to connect, which is uncertainty, but that also makes it very exciting. But obviously, as we scale regionally, getting the right team on board is going to be very important for us. Making sure that we are managing sort of business risk is going to be important, because expansion overseas comes with a whole range of different issues, whether it's FX, whether it's, you know, bringing the right team on board, whether it's, you know, regulatory sort of aspects of what we're trying to do, which may be different in different markets. But again, I think, you know, having a great team that we have now, you know, experience regionally, but also having someone like Warburg Pincus on board, they have their sort of ears to the ground in a lot of the markets that we want to be in. I think that gives me and the team a lot of comfort. So it's a big open space for us. We have great big ambitions, you know, to grow this company. But we also always remind ourselves that, you know, we have to crawl before we can run. You know, we have to make sure that every step of the way we are addressing and managing risk appropriately. And I think, you know, the growth and the scale will come over time.
And personally, transitioning from being an investor to becoming an entrepreneur, what was the most unexpected aspect during this process that you didn't think it could happen or that you would experience?
So firstly, I would say that even, you know, in my previous firm, you know, I had a lot of support to be entrepreneurial, even though, you know, we're doing institutional investing. So, you know, in that sense, I had the, you know, great benefit of interacting very closely with some very successful entrepreneurs, sitting alongside them, you know, learning from them, observing how they went about growing their businesses. So that was very, very beneficial and, you know, something that I tried to incorporate as, you know, I set up Weave and, you know, as we progressed, you know, over the last sort of 18 months. You know, in terms of what is unexpected, there's obviously a great big difference in being out on your own versus being part of a bigger platform. When you're out on your own, you sort of live by the sword and die with the sword. I mean, every decision you're making directly affects the business. And, you know, when the team is small, sometimes maybe you don't have the institutional checks and balances in place. And you have to debate within the team, but still have conviction in the decisions you're making without having, you know, an oversight sort of, you know, investment committee or board sitting over your shoulder saying, you know, maybe, you know, don't do this or don't do this. So trusting your own instinct a little bit more, I think that is something I've really come to appreciate. But also, you know, seeking out advice. I mean, I've been, you know, very, very fortunate that, you know, friends, you know, who've been entrepreneurs themselves, you know, they've gone through stages of uncertainty, sleepless nights, you know, ups and downs, roller coaster, and, you know, being able to pick up the phone and, or, you know, have a coffee with them and, you know, just have a laugh and, you know, sort of roll with the punches a little bit. I think that's been something that, you know, I've learned over the last year and a half as well. And yeah, it's been good.
Now, lastly, some people in the co-working industry would say they foresee perhaps 20%, 30%, or even 50% of the office property will be turned into co-working at some distant future. Do you have any kind of projections like that? Do you feel like, you know, in 10 years, even 20 years, how much in terms of ratio of the living space in cities will be co-living?
Let's look at a city like New York or Tokyo. A significant portion of people now live in institutional rental accommodation, where there's single ownership of the entire building. So you're not dealing with a mom and pop landlord. Whether it's a co-op or whether it's... So in the U.S., they have a lot of residential REITs where, you know, the REIT or, you know, one institutional landlord owns most of the real estate and, you know, there are different tenants who you know, multifamily. So it's, you know, in a sense, it's not so radical or so new. But I think what is probably slightly different about co-living is the size of the space is a little bit smaller and the common areas are more extensive where people get to interact with each other. London is another market where PRS, as it's called in London, or built to rent, you know, has taken off in the last 5 years. And that really is a culmination of what property prices have done, which has priced a lot of people out of the buying market. People still need to live. And, you know, by definition, if you're not owning a place to live, you're renting a place to live. So my view is, well, firstly, I'm very surprised that, you know, a lot of the gateway cities, you know, in Asia don't have an institutional rental accommodation market thus far. And part of that, I think, is cultural, where, you know, there's this big desire to own. But, you know, even within that, I mean, you know, millennial home ownership in Asia Pacific is sort of 11%, which is already lower than the global average, which is at 15%. In Hong Kong, it's 5%. So young people are living somewhere. You know, they're either living at home or they're renting. But how do you create a product that is suitable for them to rent is where co-living comes in. So I think that, again, the space is huge. I don't have any numbers whether it's going to be half of accommodation is going to be co-living. But I think most accommodation globally already is rented accommodation. It's just not been appropriately packaged and institutionalized yet, which is what we are trying to do.
That's very interesting because when I was in New York, I also lived in a condo building where they have large common areas, playroom, big lobby, big gym, and people communicate in the building. They know each member who live in all the different floors and units. So like you say, it's not a new concept. But what do you think the ratio of younger people owning homes are dramatically decreasing? And what does that mean for our societal changes? You know, what does that lead to?
I think it actually leads to more interaction between young people, which is a good thing. A lot of millennials, you know, spend a lot of time on their mobile phones and social media, but the incidence of loneliness is greater than it's ever been. And that's because people are doing more of looking at their phone and less of talking to each other. So, you know, with co-living, we are creating spaces and creating avenues for people to interact with each other. You know, we have a regular calendar of events, whether it's social events or professional development events, where people can enrich their experiences, they can, you know, learn new skills that can help them in their career, or, you know, they can learn a new skill, like, you know, maybe they can learn painting or they can learn video logging. I mean, you know, we have all types of residents, you know, in our building. I think people tend to forget that human beings have a very basic need to interact with other human beings. And we're just creating spaces to make that happen.
Well, Sachi, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful talking with you.